Feel like I need to set the record straight just a little bit. Actually, what took place when I got the text, an overview of the four world empires of Daniel. I immediately thought, there's absolutely no way. There's no way. So I text Jason. I said, what did I ever do to you that you would give me the assignment to try to cover four world empires in 45 minutes? His text back was, well, it's actually only 40 minutes. And then he said, but Michaelite's doing Rome, so you can just do three, so that'll give you an extra 5 minutes for each one of those empires. So what we're going to do is to strive to do our best to cover two, Babylon and Persia. If we get to the Grecian Empire, get to cover the Diadochi, that would be great, but we'll see what time allows. The majority of my time is going to be Brother Quentin covering history. And so it will be more lecturing than anything else. However, before we do that, I want to take an opportunity to get into the scriptures. Now, these empires, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, the Roman Empire, all are seen in prophecy. And the book of Daniel, when we consider the book itself, we see that some of the book is set in the Babylonian Empire historically, some in the Persian Empire, and we'll note that directly. But if I was to consider, I want to take a little bit of time and preach, maybe just a little bit. If I was to consider the book of Daniel, if there was one word, Brother Terrence, that I was going to use as a theme for the book of Daniel, for me, it would have to be sovereignty. The sovereignty of God would have to be the theme of the book. And I want us to note, briefly, and I know I'm taking away from what I'm supposed to be doing up here, Brother Jason, but I want to take time just briefly, in every single chapter, to note the sovereignty of God. And you can do multiple times in these chapters, in some of them anyway. Look at Daniel chapter 1. Let's just look at the opening of it, verses 1 and 2. Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. But look how verse 2 opens up. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hands. All right. If it was the case that the Lord did not have the desire, that it had not reached the time that would be the end of Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar would have been just like Sennacherib had been when Sennacherib came against Jerusalem and his armies was laying down, and he turned around like a dog with his tail tucked between his legs and went back home. But God's sovereignty stood. Not only that, but look at chapter 2. Look at verse 28. We can notice multiple places of the sovereignty of God here. Daniel chapter 2, verse 28, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. And we could take that and tie that into Ephesians chapter 1. God works all things after the counsel of his own will. And so we see here the sovereignty of God. Notice also verse 45. Because this ties in with verse 28 of chapter 2. Verse 45, for as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass. And all that comes to pass, this is according to the counsel of God's own will. Look at chapter 3, verse 17. Here are the words of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. If it be so, that is, if it's a case that God chooses, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And look at chapter 29, verse 29, at the closing part of verse 29. Notice what Nebuchadnezzar says. After God delivers Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. And then Daniel chapter 4, perhaps the most well-known verse in the chapter, there that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass and oxen as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven. Seven times shall pass over thee till thou know that the Most High, watch it, ruleth in the kingdom or the dominions of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. There you see the sovereignty of God. Chapter 5. Verse 26 through 28, and just a portion of these three verses. Look at verse 26. Here's the interpretation of the writing on the wall. A God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Well, how can God number the kingdom? That is, how can God set the days of the kingdom, the months of the kingdom, the years of the kingdom from beginning to end, as he said in Acts chapter 17, as Paul preached to the Athenians? How is it that God can do that unless he has all rule and sovereignty? Verse 27, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Well, how is it, is God so audacious as to number the days of a man, except that he has all sovereignty to do that? And then verse 28, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. What right does God have to give one kingdom to another, from one to another? Because he has all sovereign rule. Then we consider chapter 6. Look at verse 16. Now, here we see that Jehovah God shut the mouth of the lions. So not only among men, but also the beasts of the field. The king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And you might note here Daniel, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 33. Where we see that there were some who shut the mouth of lions. We see the faith of Daniel demonstrated there. Chapter 7, and look at verse 14. Here, verses 13 and 14, a prophecy concerning the ascension of Christ and given the kingdom. And look at verse 14. There was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. And then chapter 8, we're going to put 8, 9, and 10 all together here. Chapter 8, verse 15. Daniel having seen visions, it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And so there was one there that stood before him as it was an angel of God. We're going to demonstrate that. He appeared as a man. Look at chapter 9, verse 23. Verse 23, at the beginning of thy supplications, and this is the angel Gabriel speaking, at the beginning of thy supplications the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. All right, here it is. Daniel is seeking the answer to the vision. He prays to Jehovah God for the vision, and here is one who is sent. So not only, Brother Terrence, among the kingdoms of men, but also in heavenly places does God have sovereign rule and commands. Then chapter 10. Verse 12 demonstrates the same. Then said he unto me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words, sent by Jehovah God. Then chapter 11, verse 29, we see God's sovereignty here. Notice how just the opening part of this verse, the sovereignty of God is implied. At the time appointed. What time appointed? Well, that's going to fall within the time that God has appointed. Then chapter 12, verses 8 and 9. And this is interesting. We start at chapter 2. There's a God in heaven who makes things known. God has revealed these things. Daniel in chapters 8, 9, and 10, he appealed wanting to know the meaning of the vision. He prayed to God. Gabriel is sent. He informs him. But look at verses 8 and 9 of chapter 12. And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Daniel, you're not going to know the meaning of this. You know why? Because Jehovah God does not see fit to render the explanation to you. And so from beginning to end, and we could multiply the illustrations of this, the sovereignty of God is demonstrated in the book of Daniel. And whenever we consider these four world empires, God determined the boundaries, the times when they would rise up and the times when they would fall. God determined it. God did it according to his sovereignty. Well, let's get into our lesson this morning. The four world empires that are mentioned in the book of Daniel, we've noted them. The Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, Achaemenid Empire, as history would refer to it. The Grecian Empire and the Roman Empire. Daniel chapters 1 through 5, and then 7 and 8. Historically, those chapters are set in the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 6, and then chapters 9 through 12, historically, would be set in the time of the Persian Empire. Each of these four world empires played a role in the fullness of time. Now, we're not going to take the time to demonstrate what they each contributed to the fullness of time. But we consider Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4. When the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, made under the law. All of these empires contributed to the fullness of time. That is, God used these empires to bring about his purposes. We see it also in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. There in verse 9 is referenced the mystery of God's will. And in verse 10, that in the dispensation, a particular age, Brother Jason, but then Paul identifies for us what that age is, what that dispensation is. That in the dispensation of the fullness of times, he would gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are on earth. See the sovereignty of God in him, that is in Jesus Christ. What I want us to do for the time that we have is to note, especially the Babylonian Empire. We're actually going to take a step back in time into the close of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, just to kind of bring us up to where I want us to be, a little bit of background. And then we'll consider the Babylonian Empire. We'll note especially King Nebuchadnezzar, some of his father, Nabopolassar. We'll note briefly the captivities as they are mentioned in the scriptures. And then we're going to consider the religion, the gods, two in particular, and also the city of Babylon, the great city of Babylon, which Nebuchadnezzar boasts in Daniel chapter 4. So let's get down to it. I want to talk briefly about the close of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Now, we're familiar from 2 Kings chapter 17 of Shalmaneser the Fifth. Shalmaneser, who reigned from 727 to 722, he besieged Samaria. According to Babylonian chronicles, he is identified as the man who took the city and brought the Israelites into captivity. But after Shalmaneser the Fifth, when he died, Sargon the Second, who reigned from 722 to 705, some suggest Shalmaneser's half brother overthrew him in 722. Among the Nimrud prisms, archaeological discovery, we find Sargon's personal claim that he actually was the one who took Israel. And so perhaps it is the case that Shalmaneser besieged the city for 3 years. He dies, put to death perhaps by his brother. And then Sargon then completes and brings the people into captivity. While Sargon, during his reign, engaged in military campaigns, and here's the main reason I wanted to step back a bit in time. While he was engaged in military campaigns throughout the empire, the Assyrian Empire, there was one Chaldean by the name of Merodach Baladan, about whom we read in Isaiah chapter 39 and verse 1, who sent an ambassage to Hezekiah. If you'll recall, Hezekiah had been sick unto death. He prayed to God. God gave him 15 more years. You know, it's interesting. We don't read of a son of Hezekiah until during that 15 years. If Hezekiah would have died, that would have been perhaps been the end of that line. But the line from David through. And so Manasseh was born during that time. Nevertheless, we read of a Chaldean, Merodach Baladan, who sent ambassadors to King Hezekiah, Isaiah chapter 39, verse 1. He would be put down. He would rise to try to seize the throne among the Chaldeans, but he was put down by Sargon II in about 710 B.C. Then we have from 705 beginning, we have Sennacherib. Of course, we know Sennacherib, 703. We read in 703 B.C., according to history, that Merodach Baladan again seized Babylon, this time with allies from Elam. And so the Elamites allying with the Chaldeans. But he was put down again in 702 B.C. Now, why do I mention this? Why have I gone back into this time? Just to demonstrate that there is a stirring among the Chaldeans as early as 703 B.C. to gain their independence from Assyria. Okay, now let's fast forward to the time when that actually takes place. And let's talk about Nabopolassar. And let's get into the Neo-Chaldean or the Neo-Babylonian Empire. The Neo-Babylonian Empire, if we're going to set the dates for it, it was established by Nabopolassar, we'll see, in 626 B.C., runs to 539 B.C., when Cyrus' armies march into the city of Babylon and take the city. The kings of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, again, the one who established Nabopolassar, his son, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar died a peaceful death in his sleep. His son, Merodach-Baladan, took the throne after him, ruled for about 2 years. Then Nergal-Sarnessar, who suggested killed Merodach-Baladan, serves as king for about 4 years. Then Nabonidus, who was the last king of the Babylonian Empire, and he would serve along with his son, who was a co-regent for a period of time. Now let's consider each of these in turn to some degree. 627 B.C., a man by the name of Sin-shar-ishkun, who was a son of Ashur-banipal, ascended to the Assyrian throne. In 626 B.C., the year following, Nabopolassar in Babylon rebelled against Assyria. He tried to take one of the holy cities, the city of Nippur, failed to take that city, so he retreated back to Babylon. He became the king of Babylon November the 23rd of 626 B.C. We know that because of the Babylonian Chronicles. And so November the 23rd of 626 B.C., the Neo-Babylonian Empire was established. Nabopolassar had taken, by the year 620 B.C., had taken most of the large cities of Babylonia. At the same time, Egypt begins to ally themselves with Assyria. Assyria, who had once been a great empire, was really into a death spiral. You have the Medes, you have the Babylonians who are moving, especially the Babylonians moving and growing, especially against Assyria. You have the Egyptians who are moving to help their Assyrian allies. No doubt they were just trying to get a foothold on territory north. In 615 B.C., Babylonians approached the city of Ashur, one of the great cities of the Assyrian Empire. They were unable to take that city, and so they were pushed back a year later. 614 B.C., the Medes, under Cyaxares, came against Ashur and took the city, raised the city to the ground. And so the Medes and the Chaldeans then joined forces. Nebuchadnezzar, we'll see, according to history, had two wives. One of them was a daughter of this particular Median king, Cyaxares, and that would have been a marriage for the purpose of the allies for diplomacy. And so Ashur has been taken. The Medes and the Chaldeans joined forces. And in 612 B.C., the Babylonians and the Medes, along with Scythians, who had allied themselves with these two kingdoms, moved against Nineveh. And in August of 612 B.C., the city of Nineveh was taken. The population was slaughtered or enslaved. The Assyrian king's son, a man by the name of Ashur-uballit, fled to Haran. It had in time past been a Hittite kingdom, but now it was a part of the Assyrian empire. Flees to Haran. He is ultimately forced out of that city and goes to Carchemish. Pharaoh Necho comes northward to ally himself with Ashur-uballit at Carchemish. And we have a record of that in 2 Chronicles chapter 35. And we have the record of Josiah, King Josiah, who was killed by the forces of Pharaoh Necho. From 610 B.C. to about 605 B.C., as Necho and Ashur-uballit are trying to build up defenses, Nabopolassar is focusing on the north of his empire to strengthen his defenses. And then in 605 B.C., the Babylonians move against Ashur-uballit and Pharaoh Necho at Carchemish. Nabopolassar, because of poor health, returns to Babylon. There he will die. But his son, Nebuchadnezzar, takes the lead and defeats Pharaoh Necho and Ashur-uballit at Carchemish in 605 B.C. Hearing of the death of his father, Nebuchadnezzar returns to Babylon, and he is made king of the Babylonian Empire, and he will rule from 605 B.C. to about 562 B.C. Now let's consider some of the details with regards to Nebuchadnezzar. I'm assuming you're going to give me a sign. Nebuchadnezzar was born about 634 B.C. Again, I noted history tells us he had two wives, one of them being the daughter of Sacharias. The monuments, Babylonian monuments, tell us of three sons that we know for certain. There was evil Merodach, who succeeded him to the throne. Two others, Marduk, and don't forget that name, Marduk Shum-Usser and Marduk Naben-Abi. There's another name, Marduk Naben. There you see two of the two primary gods during the time of the Neo-Chaldean Empire for that particular son. Nebuchadnezzar came against Judah and Jerusalem on three particular occasions and took them into captivity. The first carrying away was about 606, 605 B.C. We have a record of this, 2 Kings chapter 24. This was a fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy, Isaiah chapter 39, because of Hezekiah's pride. God spoke concerning that. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are taken at that first carrying away. And so when we read in Daniel chapter 1, the time, we have a time frame of about 606 or 605 B.C. The second carrying away into captivity, Jehoiakim had pledged loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, but pro-Egyptian forces in Jerusalem and in Judea had convinced him to move against or to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. And so Nebuchadnezzar comes. There's a second carrying away. This will be in about 597 B.C. Ezekiel, the prophet, will be carried away with others at this time. Mattaniah, or Zedekiah is the name that Nebuchadnezzar will give this particular son of Josiah, is set on the throne as a vassal in Judah. And then about 586 B.C., we have the record of the third carrying away. Zedekiah had sworn an oath of loyalty, but this time anti-Babylonian forces within his kingdom convinced him to rebel. He seeks help from Egyptian forces. They pledge their support. Babylon's forces come against Jerusalem and Judea. No Egyptian forces arrive for help. And so Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. And then another carrying away into captivity. We have a record of that, 2 Kings chapter 25. Now, during his reign, and I want to move forward into this, during his reign, Nebuchadnezzar built Babylon into perhaps one of the greatest cities of ancient times. The Neo-Babylonian Empire became one of the greatest cities of ancient history. But just to close out Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian priest Berosus records that Nebuchadnezzar died peacefully while in his sleep. That would have been in about 562. I'm going to observe the Passover on the next kings until we come to Nabonidus. And I'm going to speak of the last king of Egypt, Nabonidus. He is king, sole ruler, the sovereign ruler. But he'll have a co-regent that will rule with him. We'll see. Nabonidus was a military commander when he became king. He was in his 60s. It is suggested by some that he was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. Some scholars also suggest that his mother was an Assyrian priestess of the moon god Sin. That was the deity's name, of the moon god Sin. And his devotion to that god is going to come into play whenever the Persians come into town. And that's because Nabonidus began to go on pilgrimages with regard to this moon god. If in times past, scholars believe that Nabonidus was gone from Babylon on great architectural projects to build great buildings. But archaeology has discovered that he actually was on pilgrimages. And he was restoring dilapidated temples and shrines to the moon god Sin. Not only this, it's a period of 10 years that he has gone from Babylon. Now this is key whenever we consider how Persia was able to just walk into Babylon. There was an annual festival to honor the god Marduk in Babylon. But that festival could not take place if the king was not present. Now, the co-regent was there, but he could not be the one to lead that. And so for 10 years, the festival in honor of Marduk was not observed. Now, question, how do you suppose the priest of Marduk felt about that? How do you suppose the people of Babylon, Marduk being the patron deity of the city of Babylon and the patron deity of the empire who was to protect them, how do you suppose they felt about that? Well, that attitude is going to come into play. And so it was during this 10 years that Belshazzar would have been appointed as co-regent with his father. Now, let's just notice something here. Let's go to Daniel chapter 5. We'll get an opportunity to get back into the scriptures here. Daniel chapter 5. I'm not going to, Brother Terrence, you may find this. I'll talk about it. Maybe you can find the scripture and we can read it. Belshazzar sees the writing on the wall, he calls for Belteshazzar, Daniel, to give the interpretation of the writing on the wall. And he said, if you can tell me the interpretation of this writing, you will be elevated to the third in the empire. Well, why didn't he say you'll be promoted to the second in the empire? Because he was a second in the empire. He was a co-regent. All right? So Nabonidus, king, Belshazzar, co-regent, and now Daniel, because he gives the interpretation, is the third in the kingdom. I want you to notice what God has done. He brings Daniel into the kingdom, into the Babylonian empire. He will remain through the entirety of that empire, through the entirety of that 70-year captivity. And over the course of that time, he'll begin being over all the governors. He is a great advisor to the kings of Babylon. Ultimately now rises to third position. Well, what happens to Nabonidus? Well, history, some say that he was killed. Some say that he was taken into captivity and made an advisor. What happened to Belshazzar? We don't have to wonder about that because we see at the end of chapter 5 that he died that night. Okay, Nabonidus the king is gone. Belshazzar, the co-regent, is dead. Well, who in the world is in charge in this place? And whenever Darius comes in, he's saying, okay, who's in charge? We have to work some things out. And Cyrus comes in. Who is the one who is in charge? Guess who it is? God's man. God's man. Do you suppose that Daniel, we know that Daniel had the writings of Jeremiah. You suppose that Daniel had the writings of Isaiah? I wonder who it was that communicated to Cyrus the prophecy of Cyrus the Great called by name in Isaiah some 150 years before he was ever even born. Well, you see what? God's sovereignty in all of this. So, Nabonidus taken, Belshazzar, all of this is in 539. Belshazzar, the co-regent, dies. Daniel chapter 5, the closing of Daniel chapter 5. And so the end of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Now, we're not going to stop there and move on into the Persians because I want to talk a little bit about first the gods of Babylon, some of them, and then I want to talk some about the city of Babylon itself because Daniel chapter 4 spent some time. Nebuchadnezzar, you know, you can see him. I picture Nebuchadnezzar walking around on the walls of Babylon and just kind of looking out over everything or standing maybe at the top of the ziggurat where the temple of Marduk was, just looking over Babylon and just kind of sticking his chest out, just thinking how great he was. And God said, well, you're not that great. And so we're going to know some of these things. Let's talk about the gods of Babylon. During the Neo-Babylonian Empire, there were two primary gods, two chief deities that were honored. We're going to say there were many, many more, but two chief deities. One was Marduk. The other was Nabu or Nebo. Let's talk a little bit about the god Marduk. In early Chaldean history, Marduk was a minor deity, especially in comparison to those that had been the chief deities at that particular time. But in the Neo-Babylonian Empire, he was the patron deity. Oh, let me also mention this. Some of you, if you've studied Bible archaeology or Babylonian history, you've heard perhaps of the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation story. Well, Marduk is the creator and the Babylonian creation story. In the Neo-Babylonian Empire, he was the patron god of Babylon and protector of the city and a protector of the empire. He is associated with, all of the deities were associated with particular characteristics. He was associated with justice, with healing, with creation, with regeneration. He would come to be called Bel Marduk, or just Bel, which means Lord. He is, in the Old Testament, we have a record of him in Jeremiah chapter 50. Let's get back into the Bible. Look, open your Bible to Jeremiah chapter 50. Let's read verses 1 and 2. And here we'll see this particular deity mentioned. Jeremiah chapter 50, verses 1 and 2. The word that the Lord spake against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans, Jeremiah the prophet. Declare ye among the nations and publish and set it. Now notice what time we're in, the time of Jeremiah, the time of the captivity, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Set up a standard. Publish and conceal not. Say Babylon is taken. Bel is confounded. Merodach is broken in pieces. Her idols are found. Her images are broken in pieces. Bel, Merodach. That was the chief deity at that time. And so we have a mention of that deity there. Then we have another of the chief deities in the Neo-Chaldean period, Nebu, N-A-B-U, or Nebo, N-E-B-O, the son of Marduk, according to their myth. He was the patron deity of the city of Borsippa, which was one of the holy cities of the empire. He was noted as the god of wisdom and writing, generally depicted with a stylus and a clay tablet when they had images of him. And the name of this particular deity is seen both in Nabopolassar, who established the Neo-Babylon Empire, and Nebuchadnezzar. And you can see the names of the Babylonian deities in the names of the rulers. In fact, Daniel's name became what? Belteshazzar. Well, you see Bel there. And then you had Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and you see their names of the Babylonian deities that they were given. Religion, and this is the primary reason I wanted to note this, religion contributed significantly to the fall of Babylon, according to history. Now let's consider this. It is suggested by scholars that the priests of Marduk were directly responsible for the fall of Babylon. Now, question, why would the priests of the chief deity of the city of Babylon have any desire to see the city of Babylon transferred from the Babylonian kings to a Persian king? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Well, where had the king of Babylon been for 10 years? He is off rebuilding temples and shrines to an Assyrian deity and forsaking their patron deity. And they've taken great offense to this. And so when the Persians come in, history tells us that there was perhaps some allegiance or alliance, better stated, alliance made with the Persians and the Medes to allow them to come in. And so the Cyrus Cylinder records, Marduk, this is Cyrus now, and I've got a, we have a replica of the Cyrus Cylinder up here. If you want to see that after this session, you're welcome to come up and look at that. Have you mentioned anything about the library? You'll do that after, okay, and I'll just keep on going then. But on this cylinder, and if we could read their cuneiform, I'd just pick it up and read it to you. Marduk scanned and looked through all the countries, searching for a righteous ruler. He pronounced the name Cyrus, king of Anshan, declared him to become the ruler of the world. And so Cyrus showed favor to the priests. He fulfilled, now think about this, for 10 years there has been no festival to Marduk. Cyrus comes in, and in agreement with the priests, and what's the first thing they do? Well, when Nabonidus, who had been in Arabia, hears that the Medes and the Persians are beginning to press into Babylonia, he then returns. And he comes, rather than just come to Babylon, and there depend on Marduk, the patron god of the city, he then begins to bring other foreign deities to the city to trust in them. Well, that doesn't sit very good with Marduk. What does Cyrus do? He returns all of the foreign deities back to the cities from whence they came. And he also restored the shrines of Marduk. And one of the very first things they had was the festival honoring Marduk, according with Cyrus leading this, according to their customs. Nebuchadnezzar's empire. Let's talk a little bit about the city. How much time have I got? 10 minutes? Okay, 10 minutes. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. Let's talk a little bit about the city of Babylon. Daniel chapter 4. Let's get back into the text. Daniel chapter 4, verse 30. The king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" Well, generally we focus on the personal pronouns of Nebuchadnezzar there. I have done this. It's my city. It's for my glory. And of course, Jehovah God takes care of that and humbles this great king. But I just want us to note here, this great Babylon. City of Babylon is said to have been one of the most magnificent cities of the ancient world. In fact, it's said that one of the seven wonders of the ancient world was in Babylon. Does anybody know what that wonder would happen to have been? Okay, the Hanging Gardens. The Hanging Gardens. Herodotus said that the Hanging Gardens was present there. City of Babylon. Herodotus, who lived 150 years after Nebuchadnezzar, described the city as a vast square, 55 and one quarter miles. Okay, so you can imagine the size of this city. It was surrounded by a moat of running water. So you have the city itself, and then surrounding that city is a moat of water. Not only that, but you had a wall, which we're about to talk about, around that city. Then you had the moat. Then you had another wall. And so you see the great defense. And all of this was built up by Nebuchadnezzar. And he didn't only take care of Babylon. He also built up and made great and glorious and very well defended other cities throughout the empire. In 1898, an archaeologist by the name of Robert Caldaway began excavations in Babylon. Of the numerous things that were discovered, to me, the most impressive has to be the wall, the Great Wall of Babylon. The city proper was surrounded by a brick wall 22 and one-third feet thick. Okay, 22 feet thick. Outside this wall was a space of 38 and a third feet. There you would have the moat. Then another wall, 25 feet thick. Now you imagine the defenses. Now along the outer wall were watchtowers. These watchtowers, 90 feet tall, 27 feet wide, spaced at 160 feet. So every 160 feet, so we're talking about half of a football field, at about the 50-yard line, every 50-yard line, here's another tower. And it's not just some small tower, 90 feet tall, 27 feet wide. Caldaway suggests, based on the distance of these and the size of the wall, there would have been 360 watchtowers on this outer wall of the city of Babylon. Now, does that give you cause to think about any particular passage of Scripture? Do you suppose Ezekiel ever saw any of those towers? Let's look at Ezekiel chapter 3 for just a moment. Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 17. This is where my mind went. Whenever I think of these 160 watchtowers along the outer wall of Babylon, some 90 feet tall, 27 feet wide, here's where my mind goes. Son of man, I've made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. And you can just see that Ezekiel, hearing the words of God, you're a watchman. You give a call. You give a cry. You can just see Ezekiel looking up at these great watchtowers around the city of Babylon, in which he is a captive. Ancient historians said with regards to the size of these walls that two chariots could be driven side by side on a road. The wall, you could drive all the way around the city on these walls. with two chariots side by side, generally pulled by two horses apiece. And so this gives us an idea of the size of this wall. In addition to the wall itself, there were numerous gates in the city walls. Herodotus suggests there's 100 gates, but many scholars suggest, well, that may be hyperbole. Nevertheless, that's what Herodotus said, 100 gates. The most famous entrance was the Ishtar Gate. Well, I got about 5 minutes, give or take. The Ishtar Gate, 15 feet wide, 35 feet high, which led to what is referred to as the procession way. The procession way, which is itself, that particular street itself, that causeway, was near 75 feet wide and led to the Temple of Marduk. And that particular street or causeway was used for the annual festival. So Cyrus comes in, and one of the first things he does is has this festival, and he now is walking down the processional way to the Temple of Marduk, honoring that particular deity and gaining supporters from the Chaldeans, from the Babylonians. The Temple of Marduk sat at the top of a ziggurat. A ziggurat, if you're not familiar with Bible archaeology, that would be like a pyramid, but it's referred to as a step pyramid. And so there would be a base, and then there would be another level on top of that, but it would be shorter. And so it would just come up and just step all the way up. And it was seven levels of this particular ziggurat, and it rose 300 feet high. 300 feet high, this ziggurat. Now, what was the landscape of Babylon? You know, I'm from West Tennessee, kind of rolling hills, or if you go into East Tennessee, or you have the Smoky Mountains. If you want to see real mountains, where do we need to go, Brother Terrence? You go to Colorado, Arizona, to the Rockies. But this was a level plains, okay, very flat area. How far away do you suppose people could be to see that ziggurat, see that temple sitting on top of that? The entire city could have seen that. Let's just see if Brother Jason is a true Aggies fan. How tall is the Aggies water tower here in College Station? See, a true Aggies fan would know the answer to that. Now, I'm not an Aggies fan, but I can search Google, and it's 186 feet high, 186 feet tall. This ziggurat is 300 feet tall. Okay. Now, you can see that water tower from various places in College Station. Right? So it's about double the height of that. Now, I also have to point this out, and Brother Jason is going to allow me the extra time if I need it. The ziggurat was said to have been made of, are you ready for this, 58 million bricks. I'm trying to tie things into the text. 58 million bricks. Can you imagine how many kilns it would take to make that many bricks? And it said archaeologists have found Nebuchadnezzar's name stamped on these bricks. 58 million bricks. Well, do we read anything in the text of the book of Daniel? Maybe a brick kiln, a furnace was used. So I did a little bit of research. Babylonian brick kilns, their average temperature would be between 1,290 degrees to 1,900 degrees. Well, Daniel chapter 3, 19 through 22, what did Nebuchadnezzar say? Turn it up. That's not hot enough. Turn it up. Seven times what it normally is. In other words, you get that as hot as you can possibly get it. Well, they were not wanting for furnaces in the Babylonian Empire. Now let's close. We have about 2 minutes left. So let's just talk a little bit more with regards to these the deities. I noted two chief deities in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Ancient inscriptions reveal the total number of shrines in the city. Okay? Total number of shrines. There were 53 temples of the great gods, 55 shrines dedicated to Marduk, 300 shrines belonging to earth deities, 600 shrines for celestial deities, 180 altars to the goddess Ishtar, who is referred to as the Queen of Heaven. She was the goddess of love and fertility and war. 180 altars to the god Nergal, who was the god of the underworld. 12 altars to various other deities. Now, I didn't take time and add all of that up. But, you know, we're talking, what, 500, 600 different shrines and altars to the deities of the Babylonians. The king's greatest palace, located just north of the ziggurat, which is also where the Hanging Gardens was said to be. And so the Neo-Babylonian Empire, Brother Jason, I apologize for not being able to cover those other two. I'll have these notes formatted properly, and we'll be able to upload those, and we'll have more information with regards to not only the Babylonian Empire, but also the Persian and the Grecian Empire and the Diadochi, which came from Alexander's generals. I appreciate your time and attention. I know that history is not for everybody, but I appreciate your time and attention in our study of the Neo-Babylonian Empire today.